This episode of Rural contains language which may be offensive to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
So rural, what's rural? It's a mindset. You know, I don't plan on ever living in a city. You know, every time I go, I sometimes look at things and I think, God, you know, that's a cool little house. I wish it was out at my house and not there. The idea of living that close to my neighbor is horrifying. And also, there's not enough ground to do the things that I would always want to be able to do.
Dr. Lenny Sorensen, a William & Mary graduate, scholar, historian, cultural preservationist, a Netflix feature on High on the Hog, and so much more, shares her deeply bona fide perspective. Hold on, though. It's a wild ride and not for the faint of heart. She delivers tough messages in an irreverent style and is a strong and compassionate voice everyone should hear if we want to do better going forward. She also offers ideas and solutions. Lenny, tell us a little bit about yourself.
My doctorate is in African American history and culture. I've been thinking broadly for a long, long time on that intersection of African Americans, enslavement, freedom, the 20th century, but I've always been interested in agriculture and food, I mean, as a way to get into any of those discussions. I've worked in the museum field for a long time, and particularly at Monticello as the African American research historian. In my own personal life, writing about the home economy. What are people doing today and how does that connect? What are things about the past that are relevant and what are things about the past that are mythic and need to kind of drop them?
What do you think of when we talk about a rural community or a rural area?
Since 1974, with very few exceptions, I have lived without streetlights or sidewalks. So I'm decidedly rural. I lived 18 months in Detroit, right in the middle of the heart of the city. That was a wonderful experience, an amazing, eye-opening experience. I lived in Williamsburg when I was in graduate school. Well, it was interesting, being able to walk down the street and buy ice cream, okay? So I think of rural as out, you know, away from the city, out of town. Rural is no longer just people who have been wherever that is for generations. Often in rural areas, and you certainly know this, incomers who have come in and bought larger pieces of land to lead a rural lifestyle, but whose financial situation does not depend on living on the land. Now, many of these older people who have been there for generations, they no longer earn their majority of their living off the land. They've either had to sell off little pieces of their lands, divided the land so their children could have some acreage, you know, so that people have often, whose children would like to come back to the land, have not been able to easily do that. Rural is a state of mind. It's more than just a demographic, you know, how many people live per square mile. Because it depends on what the people are doing. I live in the western part of my county, and there's just people who have wedding venues, and they have orchards, and they have vineyards, and they have businesses, and myself included, where I can get online and I can do a lot of what I do.
What is the path that led you to where you are today?
My late husband and I farmed on his grandfather's homestead land in South Dakota for 8 years, so I milked a lot of cows, raised sheep and pigs and turkeys and ducks, and cooked on a cook stove, chopped a lot of wood, hauled a lot of water, which has allowed me to have a sense of what is possible. And how do you do a lot with a little? How can you use older methods to do things that are very helpful? I live on a small holding of 5.1 acres. On that, I have chickens for eggs, and I sometimes raise chickens for meat. Every other year or so, I raise a hog. We have a large garden. For other people, town is wonderful, as big as this country is, that we can't figure out ways to help people who would like to live out of cities figure out how to live out of cities. I'm a glass half full, and also I hate the notion that you can't get there from here. We can always get there from here. We just have to be thoughtful and humane and take the time, and there's a lot of different ways to approach it, and it's kind of where I'm at.
Rural areas lose their native sons and daughters. How do we attract and keep young people to and in rural areas?
Young people, they need to live in town. They need to go to town. You know, everything's up to date in Kansas City. They've gone about as far as they can go. You know, that whole notion of how are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Perry? There's a lot of people who need, who would love to live in the country and can't. There's a lot of people who live in the country and just have to go, they just have to bite that bullet and drive that distance in order to earn any kind of income to continue to live in the country on the land that they've had.
Why is the population in rural areas declining? Is there growth in any sector of rural areas?
You know, we have a culture in which the majority of people are urban, are semi-urban, and yet who are also fascinated by what they feel is an older time, older methods, older strategies of security, the stocking up syndrome and prepping. And I mean, there's many, many kinds of issues of that can be that are interesting. But my main focus has become how to help people better gain a sense of and a strategy for what I call home provisioning, having what you want when you want it. I think a lot of the appeal for the past has been daunting to people because they feel like, well, I don't have a farm and I don't have a great big backyard and or I don't know anything about farming or I don't have an aunt that can teach me this or that. But we now see this tremendous resurgence, and especially after the COVID year, of interest in these things. And there's a lot of information out there, a goodly amount of it good, some substantial amount of it mythic and not very helpful, and we kind of need help parsing that. And so that's part of what I see myself doing.
You teach home provisioning. Would you explain what that is and why it's important to you?
There's a resurgence on a smaller scale of householders who are interested in having a certain kind of food security, and that's where home provisioning comes in. How to utilize what you personally can grow and preserve, what can you buy and find in your local region that you can afford, how to store it, how to keep it. And then there's that larger, that much larger. Oh yeah, well, you know, the chickens were 99 cents a pound, by God, and I bought them because I now have 15 chickens in my freezer and I canned a bunch of stock and I broke up all the chickens into the kind of pieces of chicken that we like in our family for the next 3 months or whatever. My family has chickens at 99 cents a pound, which is what I can afford because I'm still only earning, you know, $11.50 an hour. All the way down to somebody lives in a 400 square foot apartment and they're on the fourth floor, but they got a little sunshine in one of those windows. Well, let's see. You could grow a basil in the summer in one pot and you could have a rosemary. It may survive the winter. Wouldn't that be fun? And you're going to learn how to do that. And every time I open that jar of store-bought commercial tomato sauce, I'm adding my rosemary and my basil. If that's the only place you can start, by God, start there. Do you see what I mean? That's the place of learning where each of us is, and then having a sense of these larger entities, kind of like layers of an onion that go out and out and out, out to the big commercial entities. Hardly anybody has the room and the space to grow enough wheat for our country to have enough bread. You need huge, big sections of land so that great big, the contract combiners can come through there and in one day when the wheat is at the right humidity so that it can go to wherever it needs to go to make bread for people. Well, a lot of people are going to buy their bread already baked, already sliced, fine. But a lot of people are now wanting to, I'm not going to break all my bread. I want to break bread once a week. That's my goal. Now you can get great flour. You can even buy 5, 10, 15. I buy flour 50 pounds at a time. How do you store that? The level that is appropriate to how you live. And so I'm encouraged that people want to know these things. And I want to help people be aware of the people that are out there.
Very cool. Shifting gears, let's talk about some of the challenges rural areas face.
So you have the incomers, the kind of people who have one horse, and then they get agricultural property tax. People who have 8 acres, 5 acres, and a house, and they still raise a lot of vegetables, and they've got we pay regular property tax. You have large subdivisions encroaching into the rural area as cities and towns define and redefine their growth areas, who are not towns, and they're not really cities, because there's nothing, you can't go shopping in them. There's not a grocery store in them. There's not a bookstore in them. There's not a school in them. They all are bedroom communities, because you have to drive out of them to go. They are not neighborhoods. They're not a community, let's put it that way, definitely. These people who have been here for a long time, they often are making their livings not off their land, because they no longer really have enough land. They can't make a living off of hay, and they can't raise enough cattle, and you know, they can't have a big pig operation. So they work in town. So now, depending on how close town is, but usually fairly low-paying jobs.
More specifically, what are the unique challenges within your rural Piedmont, Virginia region?
The rural areas, of course, are often in very spotty ways, poorly connected to the very society that they must be connected to in order to even devise ways to remain being rural. The urban centers are highly wired. The suburban areas are middling wired. In our area, the schools gave out computers to the kids, and the kids had to do a certain amount of their work at home, and they had to interact with the school via their computers. Well, if they didn't have Wi-Fi, if they didn't have DSL, they couldn't do that. Whoever makes these rules never did go out there and figure out that half the kids didn't have a connection and couldn't have afforded the connection even if they'd had the connection. In many cases where we are, not available. So that's highly discriminatory against poor children.
Another challenge?
There's no transportation in the rural areas. There's no bus to get anywhere. They built a brand new library in a little tiny town near me. The activity bus for the school that takes the athletes home in the afternoon, nor the school bus, drops any kids at that library. So if you want to use that library, you have to live close enough to walk to the library after you get off the school bus, which most kids don't. You have to have a parent that will take you back to the library. It's just completely classist, discriminatory bullshit. So the kids don't get to use the digital access at the library. If you want to go to the library, you got to drive to the library.
What about grocery stores?
The nearest food would be a small mom and pop kind of, cigarettes and Coca-Cola and stuff store. That's expensive. The next big supermarket would be another 12 miles from my house. From me. Now, if I'm going to go there, I might as well just go to town.
I would love to have your thoughts on the stereotypes of rural. I grew up watching Green Acres, Petticoat Junction, Gomer Pyle, awful, horrible stereotypes of the dumb farmer and the dumb rural people. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, certainly I'm an American, so I've been exposed to all that stuff too. I know that, stereotypes often come from a certain kind of reality. Why I found it hard to really buy into all of that kind of cultural, visual, dramatic, was that it never showed any black people. I knew lots of black Southerners who'd been rural, and I knew lots of brown Mexicans who were rural. This is in California, for Christ's sake, Southern California. I knew Chinese market gardeners. The regular world that was being shown to the average white person only had white people in it. I could make fun of it sometimes. But other than that, I live in a world full of Okies and hill people and cove, the people who live here, and brown people and black people and mixed couples and mixed children and immigrants, and I see them around me every single time that I go out in public. Now, there are places of terrible disparity. West Virginia is one. And rather than look to see and blame the victim, we have to look to see where's the money.
After all the challenges, I asked Lenny for her ideas on how to help rural areas.
I would start a daycare center for all the women who work, and we'd have a food co-op. Rural schools would be open 24 hours a day, 20 hours a day, every day. Every parent could come there at the end of their day, cook dinner and have dinner with their children if they wanted, take a class of something if they wanted, just play with their children play basketball or play a game because they don't have that at home, be around the other parents. I would definitely demand that everybody pay the same property tax. We have this amazingly huge, magnificent country, and we have lots of room, and we have lots of space, and we have lots of wonderful people who, if they just could be shown that it's not a zero-sum game, we can always make the table bigger. We can just bring more chairs, add another pie. We don't have to be greedy and selfish. It just seems that when we live in our little enclaves and we've never traveled and we don't have that, oh God, they're going to come and take away my whatever, without realizing that most of the people on the planet don't even give a shit that you've got whatever it is you say you've got that you don't want them to have.
And, we're going to go back and talk about a couple of other things, but you brought up something that I don't want to forget to ask. There's so many pessimistic things happening in rural America. We're losing 100,000 small farms in America a year. The average age of the farmer is 58. Less than 2% of the people are involved in agriculture, and that keeps going down. We support our agriculture the least of any first world country in the world. We used to spend 43% of our income on food, and now it's between 7% and 9%, and that's on the backs of the farmers. So the farmers actually raising the table food, the food that we eat, that they're in peril, they're in trouble. But listening to you talk, you seem to feel that there's a big resurgence in interest in people growing their own food. And so are you optimistic that maybe some of those trends will change as people become more aware and interested in being more self-sufficient when it comes to food?
We have the huge corporations, the Purdue's, Kellogg's, and on one level we need them because we are 360 million people, and if most of us are going to be able to buy chicken, we can't afford $6 a pound chicken. So we have to figure out ways to make it fair for farmers to sell chicken at a price that the people can afford and that also earns them a living. I'm kind of the break up the monopoly people, not to get rid of them, but we have a huge country full of space. Let's have more farms. Let's break up the ones we have, break them up into smaller entities where that way we can include, incorporate, teach, involve more people who are interested in farming. Nobody needs to raise 10,000 pigs. Just raise 1,000, you know? And then you have 10 more farmers spread around. A lot less waste lagoons in one place. We have all the stuff to do all the stuff. We just have to think about why and how. What I'm seeing, and that's very encouraging, is that certainly many Black Americans, it's a small number, but they are significant because they are vocal and they are visible. They're becoming more and more visible. People like the Black farmers nationwide who have contested and fought with the FDA over, you know, unfair practices and are winning these battles and they're saving their land. These are people who are farming 500 and 600 and 700, you know, and 800 and 1,000 acres. Big farmers, you know, that I would consider big farmers. That are not corporate farmers, but that's just big farmers. And then there's the smaller branches of that. Atlanta has an enormous number of people in the region. Young, small entity Black farmers, 50 acres, 100 acres, 150 acres, and they're producing beef and vegetables, ginger and turmeric, lamb, and you know what I mean? They're getting back into the very kind of farming that most Americans, including Black Americans, were very skilled at the turn of the 19th century when the majority of people lived on farm. We have a lot of women, Black women and white women, who are saying, hey, I can farm. I'm 35 years old. I got a little money and I'm going to grow something with a value added. I'm going to grow lavender and make essential oils. I'm going to have bees and sell honey, and I'm going to sell flowers, and I'm going to raise ducks, and I'm going to... It's just an amazing and wonderful fluorescence of people who see themselves as entrepreneur and who are working at a time when I got to tell you, back in the day when I was on the farm, if I'd had all this digital access, I could have done all kinds of stuff. And now we've got these people who are connected. I can know what somebody's doing in Mississippi. My friend who raises goats, I'm thinking of her. I could call her because I know where she is. I can just shoot her a message and find out what's the market for whatever. Are you selling Latin American customers who are buying Butia? How are you selling your goats? Are you who butchers your goats? I mean, I can find that stuff out today. I don't have to wait 3 months to find out her address and then send her a letter and hope to hell she has time to actually write me a reply. You know, all the stuff that was going on in the 80s, you know, the late 70s and 80s when I was farming. I know of one of the meat producers, and they ship. I mean, because now we have this ability to pack stuff in these crazy, marvelous boxes and ship it. It's still frozen. Isn't that incredible? And we could never do that before, and it's just really fantastic. And that means that a farm that has essentially a value added to their product, they're not taking their beef or their lamb or their pork to the feedlot and selling it. They're figuring out, oh, okay, I can take it to the locker and I can get it cut a certain way, or I can maybe make a room in my barn so that it gets passes inspection, and then I can butcher it myself. Value added. We see people making preserves, jams, vegetables, and the incredible resurgence of interest in fermentation. People discovering that kimchi is this fantastic thing. A lot of it is figuring out, what do you like? What can you make yourself? What can you raise yourself? What's the next level out? All those things to me are interconnected. The resurgence in the interest in food and food production in the home, you know, the broad interest in good food and proper, you know, ecological practices, of which some of it goes incredibly way over the top, which I call fear of food, all the way to people who, you know, they have to depend on the grocery store because of their lives. So, how to help them? I had heard, and it may be apocryphal, but it's startling nonetheless, that many, many Americans, if not the majority, do not have 3 days' worth of food in their homes. Now, that's scary. Not because somebody done dropped a bomb or the Martians have landed. It's because snow happens, storms happen, tornadoes happen, derechos happen. 10 degrees below zero and you didn't expect it to get that cold because you'd whatever. And you had to spend the money on the firewood because you didn't. And the electric bill was too high and your spouse lost his, her job. And you need to eat every single day. To be without food is a truly desperate situation. And we know that from food banks, social workers who interact with people who have very, very, very few resources, child poverty. How do we figure out how to help, at least within our own, we have to start where we are, how to make sure that the people in my household, and your household could be a little extended, it could be your neighbor next door, could be your mother-in-law down the road. Every family has a different configuration. How does our family figure having good, nutritious food and adequate water through those kinds of situations? So that then when that happens, that's one less damn thing to think about. And our stocking away things aren't because of the apocalypse, and so we don't have to have a 5-year supply. We have maybe 6 months supply of some stuff and a week and a half supply of something else, and but we're rotating it, we're eating it regular. All we're doing is adding the new stuff to the stuff at the back.
One thing that Clay said that stuck in my mind, and we know this to be true, he said every time you buy a steak at Whole Foods Market, you're engaging in a class act. Wealthy people can afford to eat well and healthy, but there's a large majority of people that can't afford that. When I think about the economics, because in the region we live in, it's a lower socioeconomic area, and we're an hour away from any urban center. So it's difficult to raise the food we raise and be able to sell it for a price that even allows us to break even. One of the challenges we have, too, in our area is that we don't have any FDA-inspected butchers. Houses anywhere near. So we have to load up the animals up, drive them to North Carolina. Farmers, neighbors will get energized, or somebody will buy a hobby farm and they'll raise, a couple acres of vegetables, and they'll do that for 5 years and they'll realize they're not making any money at all and they quit. How do we allow these people to make enough money to stay in business and yet be able to provide affordable food to the population that's there? When you raise the prices enough to be able to afford to produce it and grow it, then you're pricing a lot of people out of the market. What are your thoughts on the economics and how we allow farmers to make more money without letting people that really need to have the food, be able to afford it? Does our government need to support our small table farmers?
Can I cuss on your thing?
Absolutely.
Okay. How much does someone have to make at this enterprise? Well, we need to make our mortgage, whether it's 5 acres or 500 acres. We have to pay our help if we have any help. We have a car note or a tractor or whatever. We have expenses that we have to live on. The whole notion that somehow we all need to be aiming toward becoming huge, corporate, big, Purdue, blah, blah. No, that's bullshit. We just need to earn the money that will support our families decently and have health care, to have adequate shelter, to be able to educate our children, and to have a business that we enjoy, that we do, and that brings us in a living.
What are the flaws of our agricultural corporate culture?
They have a completely distorted idea of who the competition is. And it sure as hell isn't some guy that's raising 23 cows a year for a certain kind of local market. It's just not. There's far too many people who need beef and who are going to buy hamburger and whatever. I mean, it's just competitive, obnoxious bullshit. I was shocked when I got to Virginia in 82 and discovered that all I could sell from my farm was eggs and honey. What? Because it then shut down my entire enterprise. I couldn't come here and be even a small farmer.
I've heard a lot of talk that farmers need to organize or do this or that. Most farmers I know are working 6 to 7 days a week and long hours. Where are they going to find the time to advocate, organize, and lobby?
How long ago was it that the tractors went to D.C.? Certainly, farmers have to learn to be deeply assertive. And remember in France, when all those guys took their tractors downtown, they got heard. Well, it's time to have tractors in D.C. again.
at the beginning of the pandemic when we were hearing all the reports about the large farms, you know, plowing the food under and pouring the milk out. There was not a single small farmer that was doing any of that.
A bushel of potatoes is 48 pounds. And that's bigger than your kid. When you have 3,000 bushels, what the f*** are you going to do with those potatoes? And you're in Idaho, northern Idaho. Have you been to northern Idaho? They got one f***ing road in northern Idaho. How are you going to get those potatoes somewhere? Stop bashing on the farmer like it's his fault that you in Maine or southern Florida didn't get his potatoes. He's set up to take his potatoes to the big hub, and then they ship them out in the same way that if it's Idaho potatoes or wherever. How does he get those 600 tons? Most people can't even picture 600 tons of tomatoes, of potatoes. Most people have never grown a potato. They've certainly never grown, they've maybe grown a tomato, but they haven't grown a potato. They don't understand the volume.
Large volume also requires much labor, and you can't talk about agriculture labor without talking about immigration. Would you please dig deep into some of those challenges for farmers?
Now, we live, of course, in an orchard community. When we first came here, it was kind of when the first Hispanic orchard workers started really coming. Migrant workers were coming up. And at first, they lived in camps, campos together, mostly men. Fairly quickly, they began to bring their wives and their children and form more permanent residential places. And that's been wonderful. So we've had a nice influx of families who originally came as migrant workers. But in many other places, it's a lot of transient migrant workers to pick that crop. And then we make the visiting labor so difficult. Farms who have had Hispanic workers, they lose their workers because they lose their permits. Well, it was all I could do to milk 4 cows, and I did it by myself. Imagine, when you got 150 cows, 200 cows, 300 cows, okay? You need the helpers. You need the workers. So why are we not helping these farmers who, as you say, the average age is 58, develop a program where these immigrants who are there helping them, many of them have worked on these farms for 4, 5, 6, 10 years, really know the farm work. They got a wife and they got a couple of kids. And why are we not helping that farmer make a shift, make a move where, because his kids don't want the farm. They don't want to milk 500 cows, but they don't want to lose the money that the farm is worth, and they shouldn't have to. That is their inheritance. Why don't we have a program that can help those workers buy that farm? The kids get the money, the workers get the farm, which they already know, and they already know how to use, and they can become an entity to produce milk.
What about fear and criticism of migrant workers?
If you're not going to pay your damn help, and they don't have porta potties in the field, and the women are getting accosted sexually, out in the field, and they're only getting paid God knows what, but it's not very much. Read Terry McMillan on that one. And they're picking onions and they're picking cabbage, and go out on YouTube and watch this stuff get picked so that you actually know. And then remember that it's a lot hotter than you sitting in your living room watching them on YouTube pick those cabbages, okay? If you haven't done any of that stuff, and those people aren't earning a decent wage, instead of living 21 to a house because they can't afford to live in Gilmore, and their kids can't afford to go to school because the schools treat them like because they're migrants, well, then shut up. Your opinion is useless. You have absolutely no place to stand. They need to, go out and actually work on a real farm for a week. Just a week. I'll just give them a week. Why don't we diversify the production aspect? Diversify who's doing the production, who owns the land, who is running the corporation, how to incorporate people in your local area into your food scheme. How do we help people find the people in their community who actually know this work? Not just newbies, although you could integrate a few little newbies in once in a while, who know the work, and how to help them buy, whether as a group or God knows, I don't want to use the word commune because everybody gets all excited when they hear that. They need to diversify who owns, runs, produces, and profits from the land.
I love this because one of the things that we struggle with, just my husband and I, is, his kids don't want the farm. My kids don't want the farm. Nobody wants the farm. And so we are always searching for that couple or somebody else that we could work with for 10 years and then transition the farm over to them. I think it's a great idea.
One of the big problems, you know, is finding the land and being able to afford it for people who didn't have a dad or somebody that could co-sign the loan on the thing to buy land. When my husband and I went to farming, we had to lease the land from my father-in-law because we couldn't afford to buy it. So when we lost the farm, it wasn't because we didn't pay our lease, it was because the money that we had borrowed to go farming for the equipment and the animals and all that stuff, they closed out, Farm Home, closed out all of the leased loans under $160,000 in eastern South Dakota unilaterally. And we went farming on $69,000 plus the lease on the land. And we would have stayed there for it. We were good farmers. You know, it's 160 acres. You can do a lot with 160 acres. You can grow a lot of things. You know, we were growing pinto beans and navy beans, and there isn't any reason that we still couldn't have been farming today, you know, except that all these f***ing rules have pushed people off the land. So we have to figure out is to not, you can't always grapple, deal with the assholes. You almost have to push them way over there in the corner and then just gather the people that give a damn, have a vested interest in having it get better, and come up with the ideas from them. You know, get over that notion that, oh, well, we can't do it. That's communism if you do it all together, if you put your money together. The stainless steel oligarchs, they know that if you get into the only one way to do it, generally that is to contest them.
Why do you call them stainless steel oligarchs?
Two things. And the University of Minnesota started a program, a cheese-making program, for people who were milking less than 100 cows, teaching all about cheese-making, teaching you how to take used stainless steel dairy equipment, which had been totally adequate 30, 40, 50 years before that a lot of people were still using, 150-gallon bulk tanks. You know, you have to heat the milk up, but using low technology. My husband he built an old Massey Ferguson tractor.
He was a farmer. He could do anything.
Yeah. Right. He could fix anything, as were so many of the men that he was around. He was not at all really singular. We could have bought these stainless steel bulk tanks easily. The Farm Home Administration wouldn't loan me the $5,000 to take the course because I had no credit. I was just Mrs. Somebody and not an entity in my own. And so they f***ed us over. So that was it. Many, many years later now, and a woman, a cheesemaker here locally, was doing well, expanding, beautiful. I had the opportunity to expand to sell her product out of state. And the state said, oh, no, you can't do that because you don't have a certified stainless steel operation that we can ensure has been inspected and has been blah, 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 blah. She did a Kickstarter and everybody, you know, really jumped in to make sure that she could continue with her business because she's a wonderful person and deserves to have this business. And ever since then, I have called them the stainless steel oligarchy. That's what they do. They own all the big operations and they're terrified of competition from people they feel competing. Well, you know, the kind of family that buys American cheese and grated Mexican cheese, and I'm not putting that down, because I actually like American cheese, if it's really good American cheese. Those people and the producers are not in competition with somebody that produces high-grade, handcrafted, small-batch cheese. They're never going to buy that. Fear and greed. You have to decide what you're going to do and really think outside of their box, because their box is to stop you. How do we stop the competition? How do we stop? The kind of competition that people had 50 years ago is different than the kind of competition. We got a global market. We have 7 billion people on the planet, all have to eat every single day. Somebody has got to grow, raise, produce, disperse, distribute, sell, take it home, put it somewhere, cook it, eat it, throw away the garbage, wash the dishes, and then we start all over again the next day. The idea that all of us who want to produce food shouldn't be able to just produce food is absurd, especially in a country that only has 360 million people in it. Maybe it's 367 now, I'm not really sure, but it ain't very many people, and half of them are children. And the corporations, they've got corporations all over the world. So why are they worried? There is any reason for the small producer, the medium producer, the tiny producer to not be able to find a market and sell what they have. with the exception of those monstrous stainless steel oligarchic rules that try to elbow everybody else out of the marketplace and make it so that it's just impossible. Someone's going to come and it's going to, I won't have as much as I want, you know, kind of stuff. Whereas if you just make it bigger, darling, don't worry about it. We'll have plenty. And I've had people say that to me about food. I used to make big Thanksgivings, and this person said, I hope you'll have enough because my dad's going to come, and he really is a big eater, and I just hope that you'll have enough. I said, honey, you can't imagine how much food there's going to be at this Thanksgiving table. I know all about greedy people. You want to make enough that all the greedy people can eat all they want. I don't care how much they eat. I'm not going to look at how much they eat. I'm not going to watch them. I'm not going to monitor it. I'm going to put enough food on the table that I don't have to do that. You know, just put the food out there. Let them eat whatever they eat. Some people are going to eat two bites and they're full. Others are going to have 17 servings. I don't care. You know? And so I want a world in which that's the way it is. We all get to have, you know, we get to have what we need when we need it. And we don't have to fight for it or argue about it. Definitely don't want to argue about it. You know.
You've been listening to Rural, produced by Amy Drury with support from the Virginia Humanities and Healthy Suffolk.
Cows are hot. You know, I mean, one of the reasons I like milking in the barn in the wintertime is I could lean against a cow and she was warm all the time. But the fact is, these animals don't care if it's cold.
Thank you for listening. And thanks to WHRO for their help and support.
And if the water gets frozen by noon, they will have drunk, and then you will have go out and bash the ice on the thing, and then they'll have more water. Dairy cows have those great big bones because all of their business is hanging off the bottom of them with that great big rumen and that bag. All the rest of it's bones. That's why we don't eat dairy cattle. Well, until they get spent, and then we make hamburger out of them. To a lot of people who don't know anything, they look skinny. So they don't have any idea. So they're up there, you know, jumping the ass on some poor little ass farmer who's got, you know, 26 cows and one horse, you know, and two pigs. And they're, you know, calling the authorities on him. I mean, it's absurd.